From the moon landings to 5G, from climate change denial to vaccine myths, conspiracy theories are hotter than ever. And in the past week, Kim Kardashian joined the ever longer list of people who don't believe that Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin walked on the lunar surface. You might roll your eyes, but these theories shape how we see the world and undermine our trust in science. As Ireland's annual Science Week gets underway, we're asking, why do people believe things that go against all the available evidence? It's News Talk Daily. I'm Shane Beattie. Well, we live in an age of endless information and endless doubt. To balance it all, pop open your social media and you'll see it. Videos claiming the Earth is flat, claims that COVID came from 5G, and whole series on how aliens built the pyramids in Egypt. It is easy to laugh, but behind it all, there is something more serious, a growing mistrust of expertise and a sense that scientists, governments and the media are all working together as bad actors. That mistrust isn't something new, but these days it does spread faster and reaches farther than ever. So why do people fall down the rabbit hole? And aren't conspiracy theories maybe just a bit of harmless fun, a way to pass a guilty but pleasurable hour on YouTube in the evening? To explore all of this and explain why we need to fight back against conspiracies and bad science, I'm joined by Dr. Shane Bergen, Associate Professor in Science Education at UCD and host of the Trust Race podcast. Hi Shane, great name.
How are you?
It's going to get confusing, two Shanes on the podcast, but at least we won't forget each other's name anyway as well. Now, I'm going to start today's podcast with a few quick fire questions. Here's the obvious one, because Kim Kardashian everywhere in the news.
For the record, do you think that we didn't walk on the moon?
I don't think we did. I think it was fate.
Did humans really land on the moon in 1969?
They did, and we have lots of evidence to show that. And normally when we hear about these sort of like sensationalist conspiracy theory headlines, our instinct as scientists is to show evidence that counters that, right? And that is important, but the deeper question is, why might somebody like Kim Kardashian start to talk about these things? Like, why would she be conspiratorial in her thinking?
Well, she says she saw it on TikTok. We'll come back to that in a second. Did 5G cause COVID?
No, it didn't. Absolutely not. Next.
Okay. Vaccines, and a lot of talk about vaccines. Are vaccines part of some sort of global control agenda?
No, of course they're not. No, they're not. Vaccines have arguably saved more lives than any other human-invented technology.
And is the Earth flat?
No, it's not. Well, I suppose it is and it isn't, right? So it's flat in the sense of when you're out in a field or you're doing things and you're perceiving life around you, it appears flat. But you can go out into space, or indeed you can go up to a great height and you can start to see that the Earth is indeed curved. And that's why we have years, seasons, days, all of these regular phenomena that would be impossible to explain if it weren't a sphere.
And to answer the question, which I saw last night from a travel vlogger on YouTube, did aliens build the pyramids?
No, Egyptians built the pyramids. And we have lots of evidence and lots of historical theories as to how they went and did that.
In your opinion, where did this knowledge come from?
Those who are more advanced in other planets used to visit the Earth, and I think they must have given some knowledge to the local people.
So interesting, right? I do a module called Why Trust Science in UCD every year, and I encourage students from every discipline to come take it. It's not just the scientists. And we do a section of the module on conspiracy theories, right? And what they are, what makes them different to regular conspiracies, and how do we respond to them? And as part of it, I ask students every year to just tell me about some conspiracy theories they've heard. And every year I'm amazed at some of the new ones that come out. For example, did you know that there's a conspiracy theory that suggests that birds are not real?
No.
Yeah, so exactly. Yeah.
From 1969 through 2001, the US government murdered over 12 billion birds in the American skies. For each bird the government killed, they replaced it with a surveillance drone replica in disguise designed to spy on the American people.
Your facial expression.
What do they think they are?
See, people try to invent these things for loads and loads of reasons, right? And there are different types of relationships you can have with conspiracy theories, from those who are maybe just a little bit more susceptible to hearing them to those that might be inventing them, often for nefarious good or nefarious purposes. And when you kind of get into it, when you start to look into the motivations for people who develop conspiracy theories and actively spread them, you see two perennial issues. You see the pursuit of money and the pursuit of power. Mm. And, well, isn't everything in life often boiling down to these things? But they're often what's driving people's kind of invention of these, frankly, nutty ideas.
And I'm not saying people didn't naturally have homosexual feelings. I'm not even getting into it, quite frankly. I mean, give me a break. You think I'm like, oh, shocked by it, so I'm up here bashing it because I don't like gay people? I don't like them putting chemicals in the water that turn the friggin' frogs gay. Do you understand that? Serious crap. I'm sick of being social engineered. It's not funny.
But there's people inventing them, but people believing them. And when we did our little pop quiz there with you, you kept saying evidence. But people who believe it don't care about the evidence at all. And they don't take you saying the word evidence as evidence.
Absolutely. So when a scientist wants to convince another scientist of the veracity or the, you know, of the truth of any claim, we will present one another with evidence. But that's kind of predicated on us all believing that there's a method behind how we collect evidence, right? So there's a scientific method or a scientific process that we would say, well, if you're using it and you came up with this evidence, I trust you. I believe what you're showing, because if I were to go and do it my own, I'd probably come up with the same evidence too. But outside of the scientific world, the currency of a term like evidence might be a little bit different. And so I think that as scientists, we're not necessarily doing the public any good by just only referring to evidence when we're trying to counter conspiracy theories. We need instead, or perhaps as well, to talk about how science works and what makes science trustworthy. Mm. And science is trustworthy because of two things. It is trustworthy because of the fact that we've been building on one another's work for hundreds, if not thousands of years. So you can draw lines and threads between the work that we're doing. To quote Newton, we're sort of standing on the shoulders of giants. And the other thing, and this is perhaps more important, is that science is a social enterprise, right? It is done by groups of people that continuously check one another, right? We call that process peer review. To a listener, what that means is when a scientist presents new evidence to develop an idea or a theory, their colleagues will take a skeptical perspective and they'll have to be convinced that it's true. Skeptical is not the same as conspiratorial. Conspiratorial would be that, you know, no matter what you tell me, I'm not going to buy it, right? Because it doesn't fit with my worldview.
Yeah.
Skeptical might mean I just have a higher bar. So I'm not going to just take your word for it. I want to see. Trust, but verify.
A bit like innocent until proven guilty, that sort of concept.
Absolutely, yeah. Okay. So the bar is high. And I think if we were able to do a better job when talking with the public about how we arrive at our conclusions rather than just talking about the conclusions on their own, we perhaps might do a better job of growing trust in science. That being said, there is no crisis of trust in science. Scientists are repeatedly quoted as being the most, one of the most trusted professions, right? How science is translated into policies and put out into the world, that's a different thing, right? Mm. Because policymakers and politicians and so on have to actually put science into practice. The trust that the public might have with them is slightly different.
Does a part of you die then when Kim Kardashian says that she saw on TikTok that humans didn't land on the moon?
No, I'd love to talk to her about it. And I'd love her to come and chat with the students in UCD.
Any of you, like so far, a million interviews with both Buzz Aldrin and
yes,
the other one.
Do it.
And this girl says, what was the scariest moment? And he goes, there was no scary moment because it didn't happen. It could have been scary, but it wasn't because it didn't happen.
Rather than sort of, you know, polarize people and say there are all the people in the world that get it and then they're idiots. Like, I think that's not very helpful to other people that way. I'm not calling her an idiot by any means, but I'm saying sometimes people might suggest that people come out with this outlandish sort of statement might be dubbed as sort of, you know, kind of, yeah, not great, you know, silly or something. I wouldn't subscribe to that at all. I'd like to know why that view came about. I'd like to kind of, I'd be very interested to see, could she change her mind, you know? Would the right combination of people and evidence to go back to that maybe change her mind?
Well, maybe you should do a TikTok video, because that's where she gets her information from, perhaps. Honest, are there certain types of people who believe conspiracy theories?
There are certain groups that are more likely to subscribe to conspiracy theories than others. There are those, you're not going to be surprised, those who spend a huge amount of time on their own, and those, unfortunately, who, whether it's chicken or egg, those who tend to be vote more right than left. So there are kind of tendencies towards it. Of course, there are sometimes conspiracies that are real, but the difference between, like, say, Guy Fawkes Day, it's famous for being a conspiracy, right? So there was a small group of people who tried to overthrow the British monarchy by blowing up the Houses of Parliament, and an idea as to what their motivations would be is a conspiracy theory. But it's generally accepted to be true that that's what they were doing. There are other types of conspiracy, like the ones you just read out, that we didn't land on the moon, that 5G caused COVID, etc. They're what we would call kind of the more modern version of conspiracy theories. And they have a couple of qualities in common. And one of the most important ones is that they tend to be completely nonsensical, right? And amateurish in the evidence that they provide. So being able to distinguish between the wacky and perhaps the, you know, maybe there's something there type, that's important. And that's why we have to rely on good media and good education in our society as so-called trust proxies.
Do you think the pandemic has made conspiracy theories worse, or made more people believe conspiracy theories since the pandemic?
I don't know. I haven't seen a lot of evidence to that effect. Conspiracy theories are not new. So during the Black Death, there were conspiracy theories that Jewish people in Europe were poisoning wells, and that was causing the death of millions of people. So, and there have been many others over the course of histories. So as to whether we live in a golden age for them or not, I'm not sure. Whether the pandemic has had a big effect, possibly, insofar as that a socio-scientific issue was now at the centre of what our population was interested in. And what concerns me at the moment is that we see that, unfortunately, the rise of people in power that might be conspiratorial in their thinking, that they're doing their best to undermine those pillars.
Donald Trump at one stage suggested drinking bleach for COVID.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Which is frightening. It really is frightening. And you say about trusting in media, there are an awful lot of people then who believe that every journalist is paid by George Soros, and the sort of mainstream media narrative is
how much are you getting yourself there?
I've never met George Soros. If he wants to send me money, feel free. But I'm just wondering, online algorithms probably don't help. If you're going to go down the rabbit hole a wee bit, the online algorithms can very quickly steer you a lot further down that rabbit hole, yeah?
Absolutely. You can be in a so-called echo chamber. And I suppose it's important for us to have some degree of connection with our media and with our educators, to have a strong sense that our media and our educators, and indeed the people that they're representing, like politicians or scientists, whoever, are working for the common good, right? And it's not to say that you can be for profit and not for the common good, but it is certainly the case that, things that, you know, like open organizations such as this one, or indeed RTE, or the public universities, or our school systems, there is a degree of accountability because we know who runs them. They have mission statements. It's very open, right? And the public are therefore able to see what are the values of these organizations. Do those values align with mine, right? And therefore, you know, am I able to establish a relationship with them, one that I can say I trust what they're talking about? It's not that I believe everything that's said on it, but I would turn them on and think, okay, they're reputable. You know, they have relevant expertise. The people working here have all gone and done training, etc. They're not going to come in and say something spurious or libelous. And it's not just because they can't, but they know that it's not the right thing to do. There's an ethic about it as well.
It probably doesn't help your profession, scientists, if they in some way receive money from big pharma companies, we'll say. You see this argument made a lot. But it probably doesn't help, because then there's a narrative in your profession that some scientists are hiding the truth, or they're in the pockets of big business and big pharma.
And some
I'm
have.
I'm sure you've seen that. Yeah. And that's what I'm saying. It probably doesn't help your profession that some do get a lot of money from these big business companies.
Yeah, like the vast, vast majority of scientists are ethical people that are pursuing the interest, you know, the research. Unfortunately, there have been cases like Big Oil, Big Tobacco, Big Pharma, where some scientists have been bought, right? And the classic case is the smoking one, right? Where the Big Tobacco realized that if they were to go out and kind of say maybe smoking is dangerous, maybe it's not, we're not sure, that the public would just say, Ash, you're just in it to make money, so you're not reliable. What they realized was that if they hired scientists, scientists were trustworthy. So if the public heard just one scientist say smoking is okay, then there would be doubt. And sufficient doubt was enough for people to say, I'm not sure who to believe, so I just keep going. And there were waves of different types of coercion and different ways of buying scientists, from directly funding research to kind of funding people that might have slightly kind of left to field ideas, to just funding institutions and so-called bonds of gratitude. Mm-hmm. So if you had the, you know, Laramie Cigarettes, UCD Institute of whatever, then you would be less inclined to go out and publicly speak against something that was paying for your students or to keep your lab running.
One I saw recently, and I wasn't even aware, this was a conspiracy theory, and I saw it on X with a load of replies, is that people think that sun cream is a scam, and that you are denying your body certain benefits from being exposed to sun, that the sun block is blocking those, and that sun cream is bad for you, not the sun. And that you don't really, that sunburn isn't a thing. And I'm just reading this going, but how, when every other bit of evidence from your own skin onwards would show that you can burn with sun?
Yeah, and it's so obviously instant as well. You spend 20 minutes on a hot day in the sun without sun cream, you'll know what's going on. What's interesting is between sun cream and many other sort of, say like vaccine hesitancy, is often around the so-called purity of the body and that kind of the idea of not interfering with that, some sort of a purist view.
Your body's a temple.
Exactly.
And nothing should go in it.
Yeah,
that
absolutely.
Is natural.
Yeah, that's a common thread in many conspiracy theories about these things. And I suppose in more everyday language, that kind of bleeds into people talking about chemicals, quote unquote, as a bad thing, right? And unfortunately, that comes from a place of sometimes an awful lot of like bad chemicals are not very good for you. But of course, everything is made out of chemicals. Some scientists, or all scientists, would say so. There isn't kind of black and white. There's often spectra in these things, from the very wacky.
Do you still think the royal family were shape shifting lizards?
Yes, I do.
You do?
Yes.
And you also want us to believe 9/11 is a conspiracy?
Yes, but the
doesn't
point
that rather undermine? I mean,
wait, no,
I
doesn't.
Can see the point that you might have some question 9/11, but if you also think that Buckingham Palace is inhabited by lizards, it kind of undermines.
But it's not that simple. There's a whole big backstory before you get to what I'm saying.
And so students, when we're talking about them, so there are a couple of things you can do when encountering somebody who might have a strong conspiratorial thinking. First one to say is, no, that's not true, right? And then you do offer some degree of evidence to say why you think their point of view is not right. But then you kind of, rather than just argue with them, because most conspiracy theorists are self-sealing, so they will say, you know, well, you're a representative of the media or a university, so you would say that, and sort of reinforces their view of being on the inside with the idea. That doesn't help. The other thing then is to just ask them why they may have come up with this view, and to really to try and encourage deeper thought and reflection. So when students would sometimes take my module and they are conspiratorial in their thinking, I refer them to literature, like just, you know, books and things, and say, please read that and we'll have a conversation. But you have to read that book first.
Yeah.
And sometimes it'll work, sometimes it won't. Like, you know, and it's amazing. It's like one in 100 or so would have a strong conspiratorial view, and they might take my module for that reason. The vast majority are just interested in why others take those views. But
you shouldn't shout them down.
I don't think it's helpful, right? You know, telling people that their views are stupid is have you ever, you know, in the heat of an argument, we might say something like that. But I don't think, and the evidence would suggest, or the research would suggest, it isn't helpful, right? Because it just reinforces their sense of kind of a barrier between you and them.
But do you not bang your head against a wall when you see vaccines give you autism, which was debunked so many decades ago, and still from the US administration down, people believe it.
Yeah, I do. I completely do. And I like, you know, I think about the things I can control then, and I look at how science as an institution responded to that. So that paper that you're referring to by Andrew Wakefield around the dangers of the MMR vaccine and autism, the paper was retracted, but it took 10 years for the journal to pull it out, right? So why?
You know, so which is a whole generation believing it.
Yeah,
as
and
well.
Even like, you know, so science did not take sufficient action to kind of retract the work, say we don't stand over it, and to do something about it. Even though all the authors had distanced themselves from the paper, it took 10 years for the journal to take it down. And I think that's something we could have controlled. Mm-hmm. The big we. There isn't a group of us that meets regularly in Switzerland in a mountain, but like we could be better at not just policing or monitoring how we work as a community, but also being more honest with the public and those around us about how it is we work, you know, and kind of shining a light on our process a little bit. Yeah.
To play devil's advocate, is it always a bad thing for people to mistrust science, or can it be productive?
It can be productive, absolutely. And science is designed to work for the common good, but sometimes the common good isn't clear. A perfect example of this is the 1980s, when there was just there was a homophobic reason for the lack of investment in cures, drugs, medicines for people living with HIV and AIDS. And it took activists to change the public narrative. So it took activists like the ACT UP movement in New York for them to start agitating to get the establishment to do something. This was at a time when the New York Times wouldn't publish the word gay, when the press secretary for the then President Reagan laughed at a journalist when brought it up and followed up with a question to the journalists that they must be gay because they brought it up. Talk about
incredible.
Homophobia.
Yeah.
So there was a sense of, you know, to answer your question, that sometimes kind of pushing back can be helpful. Mm. But I suppose like it's always a spectrum. We do need to be mindful of where things are on these spectra. And like what they were trying to do was get science to work for them. They weren't saying, let's tear down science, right?
Yeah. Yeah. To use that phrase that really annoys me, full circle, but we have kind of come full circle here, because we started off talking about Kim Kardashian and questioning the moon landing, and now I'm thinking Princess Diana, with that one touch of an AIDS victim's hand in a hospital, changed an entire world. It felt like changed their perception of AIDS, and that you can't sort of catch it off someone in the way that people thought you could.
Absolutely. And some of the names for AIDS before it became known as AIDS were like called gay cancer, and
yeah.
they were effectively, there was this moral judgment that somehow people who were gay were getting their just desserts by contracting this disease,
yeah.
that was killing people. And that kind of suited a broad, a homophobic narrative that was going on in US
because
society
of their
at
lifestyle.
The time.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Okay.
And of course, we weren't even talking about it here. So, yeah.
True. Okay. Well, it just so happens that you've published a children's book, which actually tackles some of the things we've discussed today. And the main message from the book I get is that it's never too early to start talking about these things.
Yeah.
Tell us about the book.
So the book's called The Experimenters. And for people listening, I want to reassure them, we're not getting into conspiracy theories or anything as adult-like in the book. Instead, it's an opportunity for children to learn about how science works. So it sees two characters, Luke and Ruby. They're children. They meet their grandparents for midterm. They discover they used to be scientists. When they ask, can they do like explosions and things like kids normally say when they think about science, grandparents say instead, no, I want to teach you how science works. So they develop the skills of a scientist over the course of the midterm by doing things around the house and the garden, like noticing birds, wondering why boats or things float in the sink, learning how to make the perfect cake, observing things like creepy crawlies in the garden, planting things, making musical instruments out of recycling and even an old string telephone. And so along the way, the children learn about the importance of how science works as a process. It's all very, very subtle. There isn't any kind of, you know, heavy message that's painted onto it. It's a fun, cozy book for children to learn about how to do science as opposed to just learning facts and figures. And I wrote it for the 8-year-old me, because when I was that age, while I had all the science books, what I really wanted was just to have a go and to do it myself. And I couldn't, there was nothing out there that was able to fulfill that. There wasn't like a GAA club for budding scientists. I came close with a chemistry set that my mother bought me in return for trying on a pair of jeans in a shop, but I didn't know what to do with it. So I wrote the book for kids who might have a curiosity and want to give it a go themselves.
Brilliant. Well, it sounds fantastic. It's Shane's new book is called The Experimenters, Luke and Ruby's Scientific Sleep. Sleep Over. It's published by Little Island. Dr. Shane Bergen, thanks very much for being here in the News Talk Daily studio and maybe dispelling some myths for people. By the way, the 30th annual Science Week kicks off this Sunday. You can find out more online at scienceweek.ie. That is it from the podcast for today and for this week. If you missed any episode during the week, maybe you can listen back over the weekend. We've lots of good stuff there for you here on News Talk Daily. And also feel free to give us a like or a follow if you enjoy what you hear. Until Monday morning, from me, Shane Beattie, bye-bye.